Welcome back to Austin Typewriter Inc. podcast. We are here with Evadito. How are you today?
Doing great.
You know, if you just listened to part one of our conversation in depth with Peter Wheel, then welcome back to another amazing segment that we're going to be listening to today.
Get to learn some new terminology like metallurgy.
I learned the word metallurgy, and it's just so interesting. At any rate, we learned so much in that session that we decided we had to make more episodes. So Peter Wheel invited us back to come in November of 2021, where we're going to record several more episodes. So you're going to be listening to a lot more stuff with Peter Wheel, who is an anthropologist.
Yeah, he's a cultural anthropologist with African studies, I believe.
This is an amazing experience, and you and us getting an opportunity to listen to his knowledge is just unbelievable for him to give his time in doing these recordings. So Peter, we want to thank you so much for taking your time to do that. So anyway, there's no more to say other than let's jump into the second half of what we joined Peter Wheel with right here on Austin Typewriter Inc. podcast. Welcome to the Austin Typewriter Inc. podcast. We appreciate you taking time out of your busy day to listen to our little gab fest. We're just a group of folks who enjoy the heck out of typewriters and welcome you to our table. Sit back and enjoy the show, and away we go. I want to switch a little bit and talk about something, because you've kind of, in the time periods that you're talking, I think that are, I've heard you mention it at other places. How did World War I, World War II, and I guess any other major conflict in this span of time, how did the typewriter play a role in that period, and how did it change society, or does it?
Well, it does. One of the problems in all systems, even if you have a little office, is command and control. You got to have somebody saying this has to be done. It's true that you have some tech groups today that everybody's equal to each other, but in most situations, there's somebody who really is the driving force, woman or a man, that is the driving force about conceptualization of what they're doing. And then everybody works out how to solve a problem. They may ask for problems. That person may ask for problems from them and say, this is a problem. Let's talk about how to solve it. But somebody's playing an interlocutor role. Somebody's playing a pivotal role in all of this. In the armies, the problem with armies and other military organizations is that they have a lot of people and they're spread out. Even with the introduction of technologies like telegraph wires are not everywhere, right? And as armies play out in fields larger and larger, as happened during the American Civil War, right? The Civil War is very important for all sorts of technological change, including metallurgy, the problem of fatigue in metal, which was critical for typewriters to work, right? Because we
constant wear.
Even in telegraphy, the problem was that even if you could communicate, it was often ultimately on a handwritten piece of paper, and people's writing
legibility
was often awful. Right. Even though we all see this beautiful writing from the 19th century, even in the 20th century, most people didn't write like that. They were not that skilled. And if they had to write messages quickly under often harsh conditions, it means it was even worse. Just as telegraph companies became central to controlling railroads so that two engines wouldn't hit each other, they adopted typewriters to control where trains were so they didn't have head-ons. Got ordered one to go on side of a track. Originally, they had done it with notes, and they still hit each other because nobody could read the note.
Oh, geez.
So in the military, the problem became having a central command in whatever area, sending down orders, and then getting the orders distributed. And this gets linked to the bicycle, right? Mm-hmm. I put that bicycle thing up, but there's more to it than, because they actually didn't type on the bike, but they did type on the side of the, get off the bike, typed, and then distributed with carbon copies or whatever. And then they also expected information from the field to come back up the chain of command. So command and control begins increasingly to be dependent on typewriters. Now, the first war that, well, let me move back. In the colonial wars, right? We have colonial wars in what is now Egypt and Sudan. It was called later Anglo-Egyptian Sudan, and then became the Republic of Sudan. But in the British roles there, they began to use Remington typewriters for our command and control. And the Remingtons were big. These were sixes, Remington sixes, which is a heavy typewriter. And then you see these pictures of them with on in their boxes on camels.
It's like a tank, literally.
like a tank, exactly. And then the Boer War, which is 1898, 96, 98, 99. Then you get all this stuff about typewriters being used in command and control. And to this includes mainly Smith-Vermeer twos and fours. And then there's all these stories about how tough Smith-Vermeers are. So they get shot up by machine guns, and they still work. And so you get these stories about how wonderful they are. And that Maris has a little discussion of some of that. The navies begin to adopt them. And one of the problems the Navy runs into quickly with whatever they're putting on the ships is they're rusting, right? So by mid to 1925, 1927, after that experience in the Spanish-American War and then in the World War I, they order bronze-plated typewriters from Underwood. And Underwood becomes the primary supplier to the Navy for signals rooms, etc. But there are wonderful stories in the middle of this. For example, in 1895, the United States had a problem. They were worried about their role in the world and what was happening, and they wanted to build a Navy big. Teddy has something to do with this, mm-hmm. in the middle of this, Teddy Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. And so they built a new class of battleships, and they outfitted them all with Barlocks. This would have been a Barlock fours and sixes, and then later tens, okay? Then, as you know, and we don't know all the details still, but, you know, a ship gets sunk, the main, in mm-hmm. the harbor in Cuba. And when they bring up the typewriters, they still worked. And they make a big advertising campaign.
Wow. That's funny. It's seaworthy for sure, underwater or above.
So wow. it was a big deal, and they bragged about the orders that the Army, the Navy, was spending on typewriters. And I should tell you, government orders from typewriter companies were critical to their success. And it also increased their credibility. And that starts as early as the 1880s. At any rate, the militaries, these Underwood ship typewriters, there are not many of them left. Most of them got melted down later and all, but you'll see them now and then. And sometime they're painted black, but there's wear there, and you could see the bronze underneath mm-hmm. the paint. I had one of those. They're very heavy, as you can guess.
Right.
I hate to think what they did to the feet over time. You certainly wouldn't want to ever drop one. The typewriters bragged about their role in these wars. So you get Remington ads with pictures of ships. You get Barlock ads about the ships. You get Corona ads, especially in World War I, originally sold to the British Army, right? Then they developed for the British Army the tripod for the Corona 3. So it was available by 1916 before it was used by the U.S. military. Then it was used by the military, and then they quit making the tripod, even though many reporters were using it. That's, you know, you would have thought they would have stuck with the program.
Yeah, there are a lot of British. I think I've got three Corona 3s with the British pound on them from that time period.
Well, the pound appearing on a typewriter doesn't mean that it was used in England. It only means that the company was doing business in England. And had to come up with, and sometimes you'll see both the pound and the dollar sign. Mm-hmm. There's a wonderful story during the Spanish-American War. The Spanish fleet that was in Manila Bay was very, very weak. The strong fleet was in Cuba. So Dewey goes to Manila Bay, and his flagship signals typewriter breaks. It's a Barlock. So he sends out a message to all the other ships, can you loan me a typewriter? And one of the sailors had a Blick 5. And so they send over the Blick 5, and they use it for the signals during the battle, which, of course, Dewey wins, but he's fighting old wooden ships, and it's just not a fair battle at all. Right. But Dewey becomes a hero, as you probably know. And that Blick 5 then goes to the Los Angeles Sailing Yacht Club, and it's still there.
Wow. Wow,
that's awesome.
That's a neat little transition in terms of how it traveled through this major event, and now it's a... It's locked in its location.
I love it.
What about jumping into still in the same period of World War II? You see a lot of films where the military is starting to teach people how to type on film.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. Let's go back. In World War One, in World War One, it was decided that the U.S. Signal Corps selected the Corona 3 to train people on. So there was a base in New Jersey that they taught, brought all these people to on long tables with earphones and with recordings, and they would have to type according to whatever they're being dictated and all, and they would be tested, etc. And the Corona 3 has become the U.S. military, the primary U.S. military typewriter. That doesn't mean they were the only ones used, because they needed
needed
a lot more. And so they used things like the Underwood in France, for example. Then they just, you know, everything was heavy, so they just packed them up in these. They used these heavy wooden crates, as you know, and that had been using for quite a while. And they were fairly protective, and they would just put them on a wagon or put them into a truck or whatever it might be. Typewriters become very important in World War One, and the Signal Corps people are central to that. So you get, the Signal Corps had its own photographers. So we get a lot of pictures of the Signal Corps' group doing the typing, sometime behind the line, sometime near the line, and talking about where they are in France or wherever it might be that they are located. Then when war, as you know, there was a kind of demilitarization in the United States in terms of our Army and Navy, et cetera. And then World War II comes, and there's this tremendous shortage of typewriters for the military. They want the companies that have the skills to make typewriters to make other things. So then they begin to canvass people to deliver typewriters to them, either for sale, we'll pay you a certain price, or free as a part of the war effort. Mm-hmm. Like you would collect fat, take it to your butcher, that kind of stuff.
Here's a coupon.
Yes, exactly. And you may not even get that.
Exactly.
Will has worked a little bit. Will Davis has worked a little on this. He says that the campaigns weren't very successful. Mm. But what's striking is a tremendous number of portables, especially, are marked with stenciled U.S. Navy on at least on the case.
Right.
If they aren't marked. Late in the war, some of the Remington 5s and things like that have the portables, have U.S. Navy on the thing. Yeah. But a lot of them don't. So you get having a typewriter was a big deal. Having typing skills was a big deal. They did teach typing to a tremendous number of people. The same people, and this is important, a lot of these people were enlisted people. They weren't officers. Officers usually didn't do their own typing. They may have a personal typewriter, but more often for the military, they ordered people to do it. And those people with those skills were the same people who benefited from the GI Bill after the war. And they were the biggest group that had gone to college ever in the United States, ever. And what was interesting, these people were 20, 22, 24 years old when they began college. So we're not talking about kids. And a lot of these people became central to almost everything that happened in science, art, music. You can go through the list of all these people who had gone to college on the GI Bill, which was never quite as generous after that in real terms, after that generation that came out of World War II. So that typing skill meant that they almost always had typewriters at college. They were ready to do their own typing, etc. The group that followed them often couldn't type. And typing by the time, say, I went to high school in the 50s, in that time, people generally, boys did not take typing. Girls took typing. That was going to be one of their options as a career or a, quote, fallback, mm-hmm. quote. In my children's generation, then everybody, the boys did take keyboarding, mm-hmm. right? That was the thing you had to do if you hadn't. Today, I don't think they need it because kids start typing when they're 5 and 6 years old now.
No, that's how they communicate, right?
It's with their thumbs. If not earlier.
With their thumbs.
Yeah, the fastest thumbs anywhere. I never knew you could use your thumbs. Oh, it's almost obscene.
Right.
Carpal tunnel, though, with the fingers.
Oh, yeah. Well, you bring up an interesting issue. One of the big worries in the 19th century, as people wrote more and more and worked in offices writing, right, beyond personal communication, was that they were going to get writer's cramp, which is really carpal tunnel. And typewriters were being advertised as a solution to writer's cramp. And, of course, it's not true. They cause as much writing cramp, just a new way to cause it.
They cause it faster.
Anyway, there were going to be a solution to that. And computers then were supposed to be a solution to that. And there's an interesting kind of parallel here that has to do with handwriting. You remember when, you know, that there's this period when typewriters are being introduced and people have been doing handwriting, especially authors, right? And the argument was that typewriters would ruin writing. Not the handwriting itself, but ruining the quality of what was produced. That the novels and the short stories and the plays would be very bad because the person didn't slow down and think about what they were doing. So then when computers were introduced and they're going to start replacing typewriters in the 1980s, the same argument's made. Mm-hmm. Computers are going to ruin what's done with typewriters. So the problem we have is that it's an old argument that may not be true.
It's arguments that aren't true. I like that.
And of course, the people in the 1980s and 90s did not know about the argument that was being made in the 1880s and the 1890s.
It was, to them, it was new, but I'm like, we've been here before.
That's exactly the same argument. I've heard this
before. It's like, well, so much for the fountain pen, it's going to never be used again. It's a relic of history.
People are still, fountain pens are back, for sure. There's no doubt about that.
No, well, you know, I wrote an article about this. People, the typewriter companies really did want to get rid of the pen. And it's one reason why you get a lot of letters, certainly for the typewriter companies, that are unsigned, that are simply the name of the person who's writing the letter is typed at the bottom. Uh-huh. And then they had court cases to prove that it was a legal signature. The typed signatures were legal.
That's funny.
And that's becoming relevant today, too, if you bring the computers into it. Because working in the legal field, it used to be if it was not an original signature today, it was not a legal document, even if it wasn't notarized. I need original blue ink. Yes, I mean, that's, yep. If it wasn't in blue, it's a copy. Yep. And so the relevance now is, well, we use electronic signatures. You know, you do it with your thumb or your finger. Yeah. I'm like, well, but that, how do I know that person signed it? I can't even read what it means.
Yeah.
You know, it's what's new is old again, and what's coming back, history repeating itself.
Yeah, they call that wet stamps. If you're doing architectural or structural, a lot of times when they have the stamp with the ink in the wet pad, they call it a wet stamp instead of electronic stamp because a lot of the.
Oh, that's interesting.
So, yeah, because a lot of cities want wet stamps. Drawings because they want the signature
real ink
with the on there instead of the electronic because it's totally possible.
Yeah, and now the federal courts that we deal with or even district court, state, electronic is fine. It's no big deal. Do multi-million-dollar deals or divorces, whatever, electronic signature, it's legal.
Well, there's a great legal story here that the son of Scholes and a son of Remington decided they would manufacture a typewriter. It was going to be called the Remington Scholes. So they designed this typewriter, and the original Rem Scholes, it was designed, if I remember correctly, by an architect, a major architect at the time, who also, I think, was involved with the World's Fair and other kinds of things like that. Anyway, they make the thing, and then Remington sues them over the name, saying that they can't have the name Remington on a typewriter. They have a copyright right to the use of the name Remington in relation to typewriters. So Rem Scholes loses in the original district court and at the appeals court level. So they have to change the name to the president of the company is Fay. It becomes Fay Scholes. So they don't do too well. They're based in Chicago and they're not doing too well. But they keep on appealing to the Supreme Court. Finally, as you know, things are slow about that mm-hmm. often. Finally, it gets to the Supreme Court, and there's a major ruling that's still the ruling today, that if it's your own name, you have a right to use it or anything you want to. Hmm. And they can't stop you. There was a recent case that involved one of the restaurant chains, and they sued somebody over the use of their name for their restaurant. And that person won on the basis of this 19th century decision.
That was his case law. He said, typewriter guy had used his own personal last name. My last name is whatever the restaurant is.
But by the time they changed the name, they were pretty much out of business. They made a front strike typewriter finally, and it ended up being sold to a French company, Joppy. And it became their model and their main thing.
You talked originally in the beginning of this podcast about there were 68 different companies that prepared typewriters, that
manufactured
typewriters. Thank you. In time from when that first started, how did the evolution go where they started to merge together and shrink down? Who became the top dogs at the end?
Well, some of it was through threats of lawsuit, right? I should mention on a side here, you know, Underwood came up with the first real segment, typing mm-hmm. segment. The big thing at the end of the last 10 years of the 19th century was alignment, and they solved the problem, really. That doesn't mean that others didn't have segments. They didn't work quite as well, especially on large typewriters. So the irony was that Remington, the big dog, had to pay Underwood to use a segment in the 1920s on the original Remington 10 has individually hung type bars, mm-hmm. and it becomes a segment in 1923 or so.
So that's a thorn.
Right.
Stick,
okay.
Here's the check.
That a bitter thing. Yeah. One of the processes was to buy you up, okay, right. and to buy patents. So originally, patents were more often bought, like when Hammond buys the Teratype patent to use for his own typewriter. And Hammond was kind of a very unusual person because, even though he'd already paid the guy who invented it and all, later when the guy was pretty bad off financially, he gave other money to the guy because he'd helped his company mm-hmm. solve the basic problems of getting print to paper. Most of the time, however, that was not the case, especially by the 1890s. You're getting patents being bought up by Remington, by American Writing Machine Company, et cetera, and then Union, to keep them from going onto the market or to get the technology from it. See, Remington invited even Hammond to be in their factory during the 1870s to work on his typewriter because they thought they would get it.
Mm-hmm.
But once it appeared that he couldn't solve the problems, they didn't want to bother with it. Bye-bye.
Mm-hmm. And they're no longer useful to us.
And then, one of the most interesting typewriters ever made is a typewriter called the Yetman. And Yetman was a signal sending typewriter for telegraph. And it also could play a regular role as a typewriter.
Hmm.
And it's a gigantic thing. You had a switch. You could switch from manual typewriter to being a typewriter that could send, when you typed, it translated it into dots and dashes
from
Morse code.
Nice.
And it was not successful for lots of reasons. It wasn't the first attempt to do this. That success in teletyping didn't really come about until about 1415. And that involved, by the way, the use of the Blickensderfer ball to make it work fast.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so you get a lot of buying up of stuff. So you'd invent something, and then you couldn't get the capital. It was very hard to get capital. We have, as you probably know, before our depression in 1929, there were a series of depressions in the 19th century. And small companies, one, couldn't get money from banks. And then two, they couldn't get investors to invest in them. And three, they couldn't get, even if they could manufacture, they couldn't get people to buy it
mm-hmm.
because of these depressions. And so you get a series that gets worse and worse. One of the worst before 1929 was in 1893. And it ran from 1893 to 1898, 5 years.
Wow.
And that's a period when a lot of these small companies get going and...
Great idea, but bad timing.
Really awful. Great idea, but they can't execute it well because they don't have the engineers.
Mm-hmm.
And they need to get the engineers. They got to pay them a lot of money and for the time. And they didn't have it. So, and some of them get bought up as they go along. The big companies like L.C. Smith, starting in 1906, the big companies tend to buy every new typewriter put on the market and completely... strip it and find out how it worked and whether or not it was in conflict mm-hmm. with patents or whether they wanted something they had to pay for or whether they could get away without paying for it. So these large collections, many of which have been sold off by Brecker, right?
Mm-hmm.
These large collections that were Remington collections, that were Smith Corona collections, those large collections, IBM collections, mm-hmm. those were mainly gotten to find out details about your competitor. And so you get prototypes and other things
whatever they can get their hands on.
whatever they could get hold of. And the prototypes are fascinating because a lot of what's in these prototypes never gets used by anybody. And sometimes they're very unusual solutions to problems,
mm-hmm.
Better often than were actually used.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by prototypes. I see things pop up every once in a while, and it's just you I've got that a Royal P that's a prototype, and then you put it side by side with the other, and it looks the masks of them look similar, but then when you start digging into it, there are no parts that are the same. It's like they're trying to figure it out,
and they're figuring out. And one of the things to solve the functional problems, and the other is to solve the manufacturing problem. Mm-hmm. How are you going to manufacture this and have predictability? Which brings up another area, if I may mention it. Even though we often, our typewriter companies that were successful depended so much on European immigrants for their success, both on the line as well as in design and other things. The American approach was the same approach they'd used in the Civil War and mass manufacturing of guns, etc. You make things so they can be fixed easily. You don't make things so they're right to start with. In other words, you keep tolerances loosey-goosey so that you can get in there, do what you need to do, have interchangeable parts, replace those parts easily, etc. One example you could look at for this contrast that I'm coming to is there's a very different cultural approach in Europe. Mm-hmm. In Europe, the idea was you make it very precisely mm-hmm. as much as you can. In both Germany and in France, for example, and later in England, you make it as precisely as you can. I should be fair, England, think about Moya. Then what you do is you probably can't fix it very much, but you certainly have something that's very well made to start with. So even though they often came from the same experience of training, the people who designed the production engineering of manufacturing, their goal was to make something fixable and make it with lots of parts and make it quick. Get a lot of typewriters out the door. So you get, by the 1890s, the typewriter companies are bragging about how many typewriters they make a day, how many they make an hour, things like that. Mm-hmm. You don't get that in Europe, bragging about how many typewriters they make a day or mm-hmm. make an hour. So that's one of the contrasts between European design of typewriters. So one of the things you see is you have the Wellington typewriter, right? Wellington is made by a company in New England. Then they also set up a factory in, I think it's Toronto, and make it as the Empire, because they want to be able to sell into the British Empire mm-hmm. system. And that then the English pick it up. Then they sold the rights to manufacture it to one of the other German manufacturers. When they manufacture it, they change the, initially it's the number 7, I'll think of the name of the company. Initially it's the number 7, and it's made just like the American one and the Canadian one. The next model is much tighter. Then it has interchangeable mm-hmm. fonts in it, et cetera. All of that changes with more German design. And then their portables end up being very precisely made, et cetera, from then on. But the idea in the American design was get it out the door, get it done and get it out the door, fix it. And the fixing ended up being what? Everything from the typewriter mechanics to getting factory mm-hmm. rebuilds easily done. Factory rebuilds is just kind of remanufacturing, right? Yep. And the arbiters of a lot of this stuff are the owners of these typewriter exchanges, right? The typewriter exchanges themselves then are often rebuilders and selling as rebuilder people. And they also are publishing magazines like typewriter magazines from the 1890s and 1880s, even 1890s and early 1900s, that they're selling to both stenographers and to typists.
Let's jump into, in terms of time, let's come to 2021 going in. We're almost 2022 at this point. Yeah. Let's talk about typewriters from the perspective, especially from your wonderful study of it. Looking backwards, the preservation of the typewriter, because we know we're in the computer age, of course, but typewriter is very relevant today. Let's talk to us a little bit about the preservation of the history of the typewriter and its continued use in today's time.
Well, the good thing is that we've had, and I'm not talking about my own, Paul in my book, we've had some really good books done in the last few years that are quite nice and quite helpful, that are go beyond the kind of quality that we had often before, certainly before the 1970s and such. The Adler books are very helpful especially the 1970s one. The one that was done in 1997 was mainly done a redo with pictures, which is not nearly as good a book in terms of history. The books that were done after that include, of course, Tony Cosillo's done a nice book. Mm-hmm. Rousseau had a nice book. Rousseau's problem was he wanted to only display his collection, so you don't get the range that you might get. But Tony sold and has had so many different typewriters, more than Rousseau had in many ways, that he often knows more about them, and certainly mechanically he knows more about them from his rebuilding them themselves. One of the best things that's happened to us is Ted Monk, mm-hmm. and his desire to set up a system of books that, in combination with some of the work that was done by Richard Polt in setting up a website for repair manuals, etc. The issue for many people, it has to do with why they collect. If they're collecting to type on them, a lot of it has to do with just making it type mm-hmm. well. They may not be as concerned about aesthetics as other people might be. Some collectors only care about what they look like. They don't care. They're not going to ever type on them.
It's on the shelf.
It's on right? the shelf. That's all that matters. Though for the people who are in this category, the issue of what they look like often confronts them with, do you conserve at whatever level you're at, or do you restore and try to make it look like it originally was, or do you make it an art piece mm-hmm. where you paint it a new way, etc.? And all of them have their own validity. I'm not arguing in favor right. of one or the other. Mm-hmm. I've seen some incredible things done to portables as well mm-hmm. as even some Underwood, big Underwoods, that are just beautiful. Mm-hmm. You know, they're really fascinating. So, and certainly, how can anybody complain about anything done to an Underwood? There were millions of them made.
Right.
And
right.
If you have something that's only 10 made or 10 available,
yeah,
then you get a little worried yep. about what happens with them. I think today, people really want to be able to use typewriters. Some people have talked about making new typewriters that are not this kind of junk that is produced under this royal name,
right.
the Envoy or whatever it's yeah. called. But today, the cost would probably be around between $2,500 and $3,000 to make a really good portable.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, and then there's the issue of where the skills are, setting it up and making it all work right, et cetera.
And what the design philosophy would be. Is it a German typewriter style? Yeah, or are you talking about an American typewriter? What's your philosophy?
That's a very, very good point.
Right.
That's one of the problems. What is clear is that a lot of people love typewriters for different reasons. I think that even for people like me who don't use typewriters very much, I write thank you notes with typewriters, mm-hmm. and occasionally I'll write a longer letter with it. But on the whole, I don't sit down and do most of my writing with it. I'm still using my Mac. I just got a new Mac.
In fact. Yeah, I love it. Yeah.
With all of the risk involved and crashing and loss of data and other things, I'm one of those people that backs up 5 different ways. So, suspenders and belts together.
Yeah,
but I think that not only are people, the speed is important, but it's probably more important that people feel a sense of this connection that is mm-hmm. often not that strong with the computers. I think people, that delay factor that's built into typewriters about changing the paper and all, is, I think it's a real thing. The thing that's helped me a lot now is my Apple Watch that mm-hmm. says stand up.
Exactly.
Because otherwise I'll sit there and just keep on working.
Your mind will take control and not let you move.
And I'm a very slow typist. I don't touch type. I've got a confession to make. I've got two fast fingers, and that's about it. I can touch type, but I don't do it. But it builds in a kind of slowness that helps mm-hmm. at times to be sure that I don't miss something. I think that typewriters, there's a rhythm to them. There's a sound to them that's wonderful. There's a kind of music about them. As mm-hmm. we know, they're even the orchestras, right? But there's a music about listening to typewriters. I think that people... what's interesting to me is that noiseless typewriters were never really successful. That doesn't mean that they weren't really fascinating machines, and they often work perfectly well. People want that feedback of sound. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting problem. I remember that Richard Polt's Remington noiseless, I think he got it from his father. And he used to use it sometime on an airplane, but he didn't use a regular portable because it would bother people. Mm-hmm. And I guess that was sort of the intent of them. At any rate, I think that we're living in a time when people are very interested in analog technology and the advantages of analog, the privacy advantages and other things. And people have valid reasons to be worried about digital loss of privacy. And there's another thing that's involved, and I think people are fascinated with the way they solve problems different ways. Mm-hmm. Just one of the things that got me most interested in typewriters is that there are so many different ways of getting print to paper. And some of them work better than others. Some of them are more interesting than others. They may not work well, but right. They're more interesting. And some of them are, it's interesting to see when one company kind of pretty much copies another company. Yeah. And
Corona 3.
And what they do may be a little bit better, but they won't have the name that the other company had. And I think that people who also, I love the, one of the most interesting art things that I've ever seen done, and see people, people are not doing that with computers, they for good reasons, because of the technology and what it can do and can't do, putting typewriters on corners and having people type up what they want to, and then publishing that, scanning that and publishing it online and such. Mm-hmm. That's really fascinating. People who do poetry on corners, whether for money or for fun, it's a fascinating thing. It's because it creates social interactions that wouldn't otherwise be there. So
it's hard to have an indifference to me for a typewriter, somebody being getting personal and they're putting their thoughts about you directly on that piece of paper. And there's something about that.
And that's what we're about to experience after this podcast is ourselves. We're going to go to a type-in, first one here in Houston. And I'm hoping there are going to be people there that have never touched a typewriter. They've seen it in movies, pictures, magazines, whatever. But they're going to get that same experience that you've described for the first time.
And it's fascinating. Because they are so unused to it.
It's usually magic for some of the youngsters that have never seen one. It's just their eyes usually light up. They're like, what is this?
Well, we've had a wonderful time visiting with you for this podcast, and I would definitely want to do more of these with you as time permits.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very kind of you. I really enjoyed it. I've taken a lot of airtime, to say the least.
Oh, no, this is great. This is wonderful. I'm just, my mind is alive with all kinds of...
I'm sure there's a thousand other things right. We can talk about, and I'm hoping we get an opportunity to come back here or even come to Houston.
Please.
What I love about this is that it's more intimate and it gives us an opportunity to really delve into the importance of how the typewriter evolved from its first etchings up until still today. And there's so much in between that we still don't know that we would love to pull out of your mind in terms of stories. Any final thoughts as you wrap this up?
No, all I can say is that keep on typing.
All right. Well, I'm here. Everybody, any last words, thoughts?
No last words. No, this is wonderful. I'm just speechless. There's so much great information that Peter has shared with us, and I'm super thankful for it. So thank you for sharing.
Well, you're
sharing. Welcome.
I've enjoyed it, I assure you. I'm sure.
All right. Well, we've had a great time. I hope you folks listening will listen some more to future stories. I'm here with Evadito. Our guest today is Peter Will. Thank you for listening to Austin Typewriter Inc. podcast. Thank you for listening to the Austin Typewriter Inc. podcast. For more information about our group, please find us online at austintypewriterinc.com, or you can also visit us on Facebook and Instagram. Join us next time for another episode of Austin Typewriter Inc. May your type slugs always be clean.